Today is Thorough Thursday. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Thorough Thursday, I talk with experts providing you with in-depth information about a single subject.
And I'm having a conversation with Pat Harvey, who is the co-author of Parenting a Teen Who Has Intense Emotions, DBT Skills to Help Your Child Navigate Emotional and Behavioral Challenges. And we'll hear more from Pat about exactly what she means when she's talking about DBT skills. And just a reminder, her co-author is Britt H. Rathbone. Now, I have to tell you, Pat, that I had your book in my office, and somebody looked at the title and said, well, when do teens not have intense emotions? So let's start with that. What is your definition of a teen with intense emotions?
Well, to be honest with you, I think all teens have intense emotions, and I think that that is part of the title, that dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, which is what we talk about, is really applicable to all parents of all teens.
Okay.
When we speak specifically about a teen who has intense emotions, we're talking about a teen whose brain is really vulnerable to emotional situations, and that actually react because their brain fires. They go from 0 to 100 and very quickly, very intensely, very immediately, and have a very slow return to baseline. So that's the definition. The reason why the title of the book is like this is because I don't like using labels. And so I did not want a title about, you know, parenting your challenging child or parenting your difficult teen or even parenting your intense teen, which is why the book is Parenting a Teen Who Has Intense Emotions, because I don't use labels. And so this is about teens whose emotions are really intense, and the intensity of those emotions then lead to behavioral difficulties and behavioral challenges.
So actually, the title is a more accurate reflection of what goes on in life on a relatively regular basis.
Right, right. I mean, we all know that teens, you know, like kids of all ages really, have times when their emotions get the best of them. And that happens very often with teenagers who are actually just developmentally rebelling against their parents. And so the issue is, what do you do when your kid is screaming and yelling and saying all kinds of things? How do you respond? And how do you manage not to get emotionally reactive? Now, if your teen also has emotional mental health issues, then those usual developmental tasks are even exacerbated. And so the intensity of those fights or even for a kid who gets depressed, the intensity is even greater than it would be with a regular teen or a normative teen.
Now, you have over 30 years of experience working with families. Now you coach parents and families of teens and adults with emotion dysregulation disorders. So when you say emotion dysregulation disorders, are you still speaking about intense emotions, or is there something of a caveat to that?
Well, for me, it's all the same. Okay. What I see is, and the way the dialectical behavior therapy philosophy is that underlying a lot of behavioral difficulties in teens and in kids, in young adults, is so underlying substance abuse, underlying cutting, underlying depression, underlying even, you know, bipolar disorder, all of those have a mood dysregulation, a brain that responds differently. And so all of those kids come under the caveat of kids who have intense emotions. So I do not get into diagnostic categories. In all of my books, there are no diagnoses. What there are the behaviors that parents see. And for me, underlying all of those behaviors is a very vulnerable brain that's highly reactive to emotional situations.
And actually, in not diagnosing the children in any of your books, I would think that would make it an easier read for whomever chooses to pick one up, because a lot of times when we put labels on people, it's easier to attach blame.
Well, it's easier to attach blame. It's also easier to say, and when I started working here with parents in Maryland, parents would say to me, well, can I come to your parent group? My kid doesn't have what's generally known with DBT. My child does not have borderline personality disorder, but my child has bipolar disorder. Can I still learn from your group? And I was like, of course you can learn from my group, because emotions are getting in the way of your son or daughter's life. And so I don't want to limit the parents that can come and say, can you help me? My kid doesn't have this diagnosis, but my kid has that diagnosis, or my kid doesn't even have a diagnosis yet, but I know that the behaviors in our house are feeling out of control to me. Can you give me some guidance? So that's really how I look at it. And, you know, from the time I wrote my first book on, parents have been saying to me, this helps with my other kids. This helps with my kid who doesn't even have emotional problems. This book just helps me. So it is my intent, it is our intent to sort of reach as many parents as we can to say that parenting is hard, okay? And there are some very basic skills that we teach that can help any parent of any child anywhere.
Is there a typical way that a quote-unquote typical teen rebels? How does, for the folks who are listening right now, how do they tell the difference between their teen or loved one who's doing developmentally maddening but appropriate things versus someone who's really having a challenge?
I think a lot of that is intensity, how often, and how much the behaviors interfere in the teen's life and the life of the family. So, for example, one of the things I say is you have a kid who comes home from high school tired. So you say, you know, you want to talk about school. No, I don't want to talk to you. And goes up to their room and stays there, does whatever, comes down for dinner, does their homework, goes to school the next day. Okay, that's fine. I mean, that's just the way it is, all right? But we have some parents whose kids spend all day, every day, all the time in their rooms. Their whole life is revolving around either texting friends or not having friends and being on video games, and they do not interact at all or they interact very minimally with other people, with family members. They're not able to participate in family events. They won't come down and join the family for dinner, okay? So there is a difference. There are kids who will rebel against their parents and fight with their parents and break some rules. And then there are other kids who are meeting strangers online, okay, and then meeting them somewhere against their parents' rules, or whose fights with their parents become physical, or they become destructive of property, or they're not able to go to school, or they're self-harming, or they're threatening and very seriously threatening to harm themselves if their parents don't let them do what they want to do. So a typical kid might get really angry at their parents and maybe break curfew. A kid who may have intensity of emotion may not come home at night, okay, or may go up to their room and use whatever they can to self-harm and harm themselves in different ways. So there's an extreme. And what I say to the parents that I work with is, you know, you're dealing with a kid whose developmental task is to rebel against you, but who is doing it with more of an intensity in their emotions and more intensity in their behaviors that can become actually dangerous to them or dangerous to other members of their family.
Okay. So in fact, what parents can really take some comfort in is that child who is just kind of routinely driving them up a wall is kind of doing what, depending on the age, is kind of doing what he or she is almost designed to do. But when the parents start to get concerned, when the parents start to see stuff that really seems like it's beyond the pale, that's when there's something to really pay attention to.
The good news even for those parents, okay, is that the way that we look at it is the behaviors that are really problematic, okay, substance abuse, risk-taking, dramatic and dangerous risk-taking, self-harm, those are behaviors. Okay. One of the fears that parents have, one of the fears that the kids have, is that they are characterologically flawed and that if they could just do what they're told, they wouldn't have so many problems. The reality is that they have behaviors that they're using to help them manage the pain that they feel internally and to help them regulate their emotions. So, for example, a kid who is self-harming is regulating their pain because they feel relief from the self-harm. So that's the difficulty. The bottom line, though, is that because it's a behavior and not a character flaw, new behaviors can be learned to replace those unsafe behaviors. So that even if a kid continues to have, or a young person continues to have, emotion dysregulation and emotional pain and psychic pain, they can learn safer and healthier ways to manage that pain so that they're not getting themselves into as much difficulty and they're not having as many behavior problems. And so that's the good news. The good news is these are not forever character flaws that will never go away. They are intense emotions that can be managed with safe and healthier behaviors.
And let's be clear, when you reference self-harm, you're including children, teens who cut themselves or
yes.
burn themselves.
Yes.
Or things along that line.
Yes.
Okay. And
Or even in some ways, I even consider kids that self-pierce without taking care of making sure it's sanitary. That can be also considered a form of self-harm. There's a lot of ways that kids can self-harm.
That's kind of scary.
It is, and it certainly is for parents.
Absolutely.
And it's certainly when kids do self-harm, it changes how parents are able to respond because they're so scared. And they're so scared that if they say to their kid, no, you can't go to this party, that their kid is going to go upstairs and in some ways hurt themselves. Okay.
So in fact,
and that's very scary for parents.
So in fact, the parents almost are held hostage to their fears about their child's behavior.
That happens, yes. And it happens a lot.
And it happens a lot. You speak early on in parenting a teen who has tense emotions about temperament and about the impact of a child's temperament on his or her emotional experiences. Can you say more about that, about temperament?
Well, I think that we all sort of look at kids as how their parents have affected them. And, you know, the things that their parents have done to sort of cause difficulty, the sort of blame. The way that we look at it is kids are born, you know, they're born with a specific kind of temperament that makes them more or less vulnerable to the things in their lives. So some kids, for example, from the moment that they're born, have difficulty taking comfort from their parent, okay? They cry a lot, and their parent comfort does not change that. And so what happens is that that leads to sort of a transactional kind of cycle, okay? So the kid is upset. The parent can't comfort the kid, so the parent gets upset, which then upsets the kid even more. And there are kids that from day one have a difficult time transitioning, okay? They have difficulty time leaving their parents, but even transitioning from one room to another, they have a difficult time, and that continues. So every time there's a major transition, or a parent leaves and another parent comes on, or there's a babysitter, or a kid goes to school, those transitions are difficult. And what happens is parents then become reactive to them. Whether or not a kid is eventually going to have some emotional problems, those temperaments, the parent and the child interact. And so what I see happens is sometimes the parent is as much a product of the temperament of the child as the child is a result of the parenting. It's a transactional process and it goes around. But we all know that there are kids who, from the moment of birth, have difficulty dealing with their world. They're highly sensitive to certain clothes. And then there are kids that are just really easygoing, and those kids are easier for their parents. And so the relationship, even if those kids begin to develop difficulty, that it's not as fraught to begin with as a kid who was born with a difficult temperament.
So when you look at it from that perspective, it kind of helps parents to perhaps not engage the way parents so often do in the concept of blaming themselves for their child's behavior. If the child was simply born this way, that's not on the parent.
Right. But you have parents who, I can't comfort my child. What's wrong with me?
Exactly.
Okay? It starts very, very early, All right. And then they go to their pediatrician, and I can't comfort my kid. Well, did you try this? And did you try that? And okay. So it comes back to what the parent could have and should have done. And granted, there are skills that parents can learn. It doesn't translate to, it was my fault that I couldn't do this. And parents, at least the parents that I work with, have a tremendous amount of guilt. Okay. Because in some of them have guilt, even though they followed every expert's advice, and still could not help their kid.
And okay. If a child is growing up in a household where the parents are fraught with guilt about whatever is going on with the child, that just adds another layer of difficulty to the entire household.
Absolutely. And it also adds an extra layer to the parents constantly second-guessing everything they do. They have no confidence in it, okay? So if you have a kid who's already challenging and recognizes that their parents are questioning everything they do, yes, it adds another whole layer to the dynamic.
Parenting is not an easy journey to take, is it?
No, no. And it's one of the reasons, you know, really why I do the work I do, because my work is really all about parents and parenting, okay? So where most of my colleagues, the work is about the kids and how the parents impact the kid, I wanted to provide a space where parents felt comfortable, where parents felt safe, where parents felt like I wasn't going to judge them. And I was going to understand the fears, the guilt, the blame that they feel. And so that's the context in which I work, is understanding the amazing, I mean, I cannot tell you how many parents have said to me, I'm afraid that if I do something quote-unquote wrong, my kid is going to hurt him or herself or somebody else. And there's that tremendous amount of fear. And so I wanted to create a place where parents could talk about that fear and could really have somebody who understands it and understands where it's coming from and understand how incredibly real it is, because these kids have hurt themselves. And they will come back and say to their parents, because you did this, look what I had to do. And that's very real.
Do you work with parents individually or in groups or both?
Both. Okay, so I do what I call individualized parenting, parent coaching, which it means that I meet with parents, you know, a couple, or sometimes an individual parent, whatever works. And in that situation, I will talk specifically about, you are facing these, you know, I ask the parents what behavioral situations they're facing, what dynamics are problematic in their family, and we use skills and strategies and provide guidance on how to respond to those particular situations at the same time that I help the parents lessen their own emotional reactivity. In my group, in my parenting groups, what I do is I teach very specific skills. So it's not where we're going to talk about what's the worst thing that happened today. What we're going to do is we're going to talk about a particular skill and how it can help you parent your son or daughter more effectively. So I do not get into personal situations or things that are happening in families. That's what I do individually. In the skills group, what I really want to do over a 12-week period of time is teach parents very specific skills, how those skills can help themselves to be calmer and take care of themselves, and then how those skills can help them parent what I call more effectively, which is to say, how do we help your child become healthier? Because that's your goal, so I want to help you get to that goal.
Does it matter if it's a two-parent household and simply one parent is willing to come in to work with you? I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. We're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, I'd like to get your thoughts on whether or not in a two-parent household, two parents need to be involved in treatment. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You are listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Pat Harvey, who is the co-author of Parenting a Teen Who Has Intense Emotions, DBT Skills to Help Your Child Navigate Emotional and Behavioral Challenges. And we'll hear more from Pat about exactly what she means when she's talking about DBT skills. And just a reminder, her co-author is Britt H. Rathbone. We'll be right back. when you have a situation in which it is a two-parent household, and for whatever reason, one parent is unable or refuses to participate in the work that another parent wants to engage in, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, obviously it's optimum to get both parents in. Especially because DBT has its own language, it has its own philosophy. If I'm going to ask parents to set limits, both parents have to do that. They have to buy on. You know, one of the things that parents always look at is, you know, my kid is manipulative, and really what that is it's, I think it's a problem with parents because one parent will say yes and one parent will say no. And so it's not a kid being manipulative, it's a kid getting what they need. So both parents have to be on the same page. That said, so that's optimum. That said, I will do whatever I can to help whatever parent I can and to provide as much guidance as I can, where I can and how I can. So I'm going to work with whoever it is that's willing to work with me. You know, very often I get both parents in, and sometimes I don't. And when I don't, I try very hard to make sure that the parent I'm working with is sharing what they're learning with me, because very often parents really just can't make it. They're working, they're traveling. What I try to do, actually, to sort of optimize having both parents there, is I may have one parent in my office and one parent on the phone taking a break from work for an hour. So it cuts down on their travel time, and they can go someplace quiet and actually be involved in hearing what I say, so that they're listening in and they're participating from work. So I do that to try to optimize that. Do I have sometimes parents who really are not willing to do it? Yes. And does that make the job harder? Yes, for the other parent. And it also creates a situation that may not be ultimately as effective.
Okay.
But I'm going to do what I can do to work with whoever it is willing to work with me.
Gotcha. You have been referring to DBT a lot. Let's talk about, I'm going to ask you to give us like a 60-second I know that's unfair. I'll give you 120 seconds. Explanation of what exactly DBT means. For many people, they've never heard of it. And for some who have, they've heard DBT, but they still don't know what it means.
Okay, so dialectical behavior therapy was designed by a woman named Marsha Linehan, who found that, who is a cognitive behavioral psychologist, which means that she works on changing behaviors, and she worked on changing the thoughts that lead to emotions that lead to behaviors. So it was mostly about change. And when she began to help people who had suicidal and self-harming behaviors, she got an awful lot of what we would call resistance. So, no, it's not my problem. I don't have a problem. Everybody else has a problem. You don't get me. You don't understand. You can't really help me because you don't get it. And what she realized was that people really needed to feel accepted and understood and heard before they were able to change. And so the main underlying piece here is called the dialectic of acceptance and change. We get why you're doing what you're doing, and we get that it's helping in the context of your life. We understand that this is making you feel better, and you have to make significant changes in your behaviors in order to have a life worth living in the future. So we're not going to look at what immediately helps you feel better. We're going to start to look at what's going to help build a life that's going to be fulfilling for you. The other piece that she added that makes it very different and that's becoming much more prevalent now is she added mindfulness. So that it's very skills-based, so it's really teaching skills. And one of the skills that she teaches and emphasizes is a mindful awareness of the present moment without judgment. And that changes a lot of things because a lot of parents and a lot of clients worry about the future. They worry that all the things that they've done wrong in the past. And when they can be focused in the moment, they can be much more focused. They can be much more effective at changing what is going on in the moment. So it's this acceptance and change and this mindful piece that was added to a change strategy. So we're always balancing accepting the client for who they are in this moment and helping them change to make their lives better.
And give us an example of what mindful awareness means.
Mindful awareness is you're walking down the block and your mind is distracted by a million things. And so you're not seeing anything around you. So mindful awareness would be bringing your full attention to what you're seeing, you know, to focusing on the flowers on the side of the road. And every time your mind then gets distracted, you bring it back to looking and focusing on the moment. So you can imagine that parents or kids have so much on their mind, and they feel like their minds are controlling them. I've got all these thoughts, and I'm so distracted, and I'm so obsessed with something that I'm thinking about. If we can teach people that they actually can bring their mind back to focus on something else, even if it's counting, even if it's focusing on the breath itself, which we do a lot of, then they realize that they can really take control of where their mind goes and what they're thinking about. And they have much more ability to manage their lives that way. And mindfulness is very prevalent right now. It's being used with a lot of kids. There's research being done on mindfulness with kids that have executive functioning problem and ADHD, because it really does allow them to bring their mind to this particular moment and to breathe.
I was just about to ask you about ADHD and mindfulness. So you've answered my question before I asked it. Thank you.
Okay.
And for those who aren't sure, ADHD means, what does it mean, Pat Harvey?
It's attention deficit disorder.
Okay.
It would be H is with hyperactivity, but it's really kids who can't, who have difficulty concentrating and staying still. So mindfulness really teaches them how to do that.
Okay. And adults with ADHD?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. And really all adults. A lot of parents are beginning to do mindfulness. Mindfulness for me has really helped me manage things that I was afraid of. Okay, so for a while I was afraid to fly, and so I would do mindfulness to get me through the takeoff. And I would sit and close my eyes and breathe and count. And then it got to the point where I was no longer afraid of that. I'm afraid of heights, for example. And so when I'm in a situation where I'm high, as I was recently in New York City on a tram, I actually breathe and I count my breaths and I focus on my breath and I get through the moment. And it really helps me manage anything that I used to be afraid of or still might be afraid of. So a lot of people use mindfulness to get through medical tests because they're focusing their energy on something else. You can use mindfulness to sort of visit a place that's very comfortable and comforting for you, and so that you can be in that place as opposed to, you know, in an MRI machine. So mindfulness has many, many, many iterations now across everything you can think of.
And in fact, it's kind of one of those tools in your toolbox, so to speak, that once you have it, it's yours.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm actually teaching parents now of younger kids, you know, kids that are 10, 11, 12, even younger than that, to do mindfulness with their kids, especially if they're having a lot of difficulty with them, because the parents are able to settle down and they're able to settle down with their kids. And their kids are learning, you know, parents are modeling it, the kids are learning, this is how I can settle myself down. So parents, there's actually been articles written about it now. Parents are learning to do it with their kids. Schools are doing a lot of mindfulness now. And then the schools are teaching it to the kids, and they're also teaching it to parents.
Which, again, is just a wonderful, I think, use of one's own personal skills, if you will. It's not mm-hmm. something that somebody can take away from you or somebody can force you not to use or to use. This really is all yours.
Right. I mean, I tell parents if they're having a difficult interchange with their kids and their kids are getting very escalated, there's ways that they can de-escalate their kid, but they also have to stay mindful and make sure that they breathe so that they do not get reactive and caught up in the swirl with their kids, because they have to remain calm. And the thing is that if they're sort of breathing and counting their breaths, their kid doesn't really know that, okay? They just realize that their parent is staying calm. But so that can happen internally.
You talk about an invalidating environment. What are you referring to?
Well, what happens for most parents is if you have a kid, for example, who was born with this sort of intensity, which we do think kids are actually born with it, and so you have a kid who's in the sandbox playing with another kid, and some kid takes their pail away, okay? And your kid comes wailing and wailing and wailing because your kid has this very vulnerable brain and is very sensitive. Most parents are going to do what they can to help their kid feel better. and they're going to say things like, don't worry about it, it's not a big deal, we'll go get your pail back, this is just not such a big deal. You know, like, let's just get over this, calm down, don't worry about it. We all say that, okay? We all say it all the time. And it works for some kids. They can calm down, they can not worry about it. But for a kid who is feeling the intensity of their emotions and they're feeling it in their body, and somebody says to you, it's not a big deal, they feel like it is a big deal, it creates a disconnect between what the world is telling them and what they are experiencing. And so it's very confusing, and it causes kids to not believe their own internal experiences, because people are telling them they shouldn't be worried and they are worried, or they shouldn't be angry and they are angry. And it causes kids to do one of two things, and sometimes both. They either shout louder to make sure that they're heard, to make sure that they're understood, to make sure that somebody understands that they really have a lot of feeling. Or some kids figure out it doesn't make any sense to express themselves, and they shut themselves down and they mask their emotions, and those may bubble up later. So that's the problem with an invalidating environment. And so obviously one of the things that we teach, and one of the things that's one of the major things I teach to parents, is how to validate, is how to say to your kid, okay, I'm listening to you. I'm here with you. I get the fact that you're having a problem. I get that you have a lousy day. It doesn't mean that you agree with your kid. It doesn't mean that you like what your kid's saying. But if your kid is screaming at you, you know, that you're like the worst parent in the world, you're not going to say, yes, I am. What you are going to say is, I can tell that you're really angry at me, and I can tell that I did something that made you angry. And as soon as we can sort of settle down a little bit, we will talk about it. Likewise, if a kid comes home and says, I'm an absolute loser, I don't have any friends at all, most parents are going to want to say, of course you're not a loser. Of course you have friends. You'll go back tomorrow and you'll have all your friends. That invalidates what that kid is experiencing at that moment, which is they feel pretty awful. They've probably had a terrible day. And if you can say, wow, that just sounds awful, then your kid can talk to you more, or at least feel like there's not something wrong with them, that what they're feeling, and you can say, you know, like, yeah, if anybody had a day like that, they'd feel pretty awful. They feel okay about having their feelings when they feel that when those feelings are validated. And that is true not just for parents and kids. That is true for all of us. I know how important it is for me to feel heard, that the person I'm talking to gets what I'm trying to say and isn't trying to fix it with me and isn't trying to deny my feelings, okay, and isn't trying to make it better, but they're there with me and they get that I have those feelings. So validation is just a key component, I think, of how we live our lives. There's a lot of research been done on validation by a guy named Alan Frazetti and by a lot of other people. And in households where parents learn how to validate, the parents and the kids feel better, and the kids are able to de-escalate those emotions because they're feeling heard, and they don't need to continue to scream to continue to be heard.
You know, I think about so many times, you're right, in society when someone has experienced something that for them is pretty awful, and their response, which is, you know, an attempt to soothe, is to say, don't worry, and then fill in the blanks.
Right.
You know, if a pet dies, don't worry, you can get another one.
Right. That's right.
Sadly, if somebody loses a child, how many times have people said, you're young, you can have another one?
Right. Now, the other problem is in this, and parents talk about this a lot, that when you validate your child's pain, okay, you feel that pain with your child. And that's very hard to do, okay? So if your kid comes home after a difficult day at school and they just feel like, I just feel miserable, what we want to do is we want to cheer our kids up. We do, okay? We don't want to feel that pain with them. And one of the hardest things for me as a parent has been to learn that I can't always cheer my kid up, that sometimes I have to feel with my kid. And that means that I take on, you know, I feel it with them. And it's not comfortable for me. And yet I can't, you know, if I deny what they're feeling, they feel worse, not better. And so for parents, and parents say this to me a lot, you know, for me to validate my kid, Pat, means that I have to feel that pain with them. And it's true, we do, and it's true that we have to. That by trying to take it away, we only make our kids feel worse, even though that's definitely not our intent.
And, you know, the experience for anyone of feeling heard and feeling validated, as you've said, is actually something that improves their own self-concept and their own self-esteem mm-hmm. moving yep. forward into adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You give the example of Sheila, who in a lot of ways is every parent's worst nightmare, worst fear, worst nightmare. She's the child who has a history of harming herself and then threatening suicide when she doesn't get what she wants. So I hear that. And of course, every parent is terrified that that could be their child or is their child, and what will their child do next? But then I also hear you talking about setting boundaries and maintaining boundaries. So help me understand that.
Yeah, this is really tough. It's really tough because what I say to parents is you cannot give in when your kid threatens to harm themselves, because all you're doing then is you're reinforcing threatening behaviors. Okay, and so your kid continues to use threatening behaviors and continues to get everything they want, which may or may not, which is not always healthy for them, not in the long term. Okay, so in the immediate, it makes everybody feel better, but you have a kid who continues to feel miserable and a kid who continues to threaten harm. So you can't reinforce it. All right. Now, that said, what do I tell a parent when I say do not give in to your kid? I say make sure that there's nothing that they can use to harm themselves in their bedroom, in their bathroom, nothing that they have easy access to. I say to continue to monitor your kid. So if after you've said no, you're not going to the party, your kid goes upstairs and goes into the bathroom for an hour, I would not let them be in there. I'd be knocking on the door, checking on them. So safety is a very, very big issue, and I make it a very big priority for parents to make sure that they are creating as much safety as they possibly can, while also knowing that kids can self-harm with a paperclip. So there's this dialectic of I ask parents to do as much as they can to maintain safety, while at the same time recognizing that it's not perfect, and they're not going to do it perfectly. If a kid is threatening to kill themselves, then we have to decide whether or not they need to be assessed by professionals as to whether or not they are really going to kill themselves, because one of the things I don't want a parent to do is ever ignore that kind of comment. I don't want them to give into it, but nor do I want them to ignore it. Because, and I did residential for a long time, my concern always, even as a residential person, was that the kids would show me that they really meant it. And I don't want any kid to say to a parent, well, you didn't believe that I really was going to kill myself, so I'm really going to do something. Because one of the things that's out there is the possibility that a kid may be trying to make a point and actually impulsively kill themselves. By trying to make a point. So I don't want parents to ignore that kind of comment. So I tell them you may have to bring your kid to be assessed. And if your kid is really violent, you may have to call for specially trained officers, unfortunately, to help you out in situations. I ask parents not to do a tug of war, certainly around a knife or scissors or anything dangerous, that if their kid is really threatening harm, that they have to call police and they have to get their kid assessed. None of which is easy for a parent, and none of which I say lightly. The other thing that I do for the parents that I'm working with, because I recognize how incredibly hard this is for them, is I provide coaching in the moment. Okay? So if parents are working with me and they're in the middle of a situation with their kids and they just don't know how to respond to it, they can text me, they can call me, they can email me, or they can text me a message that says, call me please when you have a chance. I will get back to those text messages as quickly as I can, so sometimes it's instantaneous. Obviously, if I'm working or I'm sleeping or I'm out of the country, or then I can't, and my clients all know when that is. But I will get back to those text messages as quickly as I can. And, you know, sometimes I'll get, you know, a message that says, I'm just really, really angry at my kid. Can I talk to you for a few minutes so that I can settle down? And that's what we do. I get on the phone and I encourage the parents to breathe and to sort of gain for some perspective on what's going on. Because I realize how incredibly hard it is for parents to change and for parents to take some risks.
Absolutely.
But I know that I'm asking them to do that. And so I provide as much backup support as I can.
Pat, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, sure. I want to ask you about something that is the bane of every parent's existence, the teen's right to privacy. We'll be right back, folks.
Okay.
Somewhere between setting limits, wanting to be respectful of your teen, and being concerned about what your teen is actually doing, and perhaps what some people would call responsible parenting, is this huge cloud of privacy and the teen's right to privacy. How much is too much? How much is not enough?
This obviously is an ongoing discussion with many of the parents that I work with, from the notion of, do I read my kids' text messages, to do I check their room, do I read their diary? And, you know, part of this is that there are some kids that have made some very serious suicide attempts without there being very many indicators, because the pain that their kid is going through is sort of internal, and then there's a sort of an impulsive need to just get rid of the pain. And parents don't always see it coming. They really don't. And so after that, parents want to be incredibly vigilant. And if their kid is not communicating very much with them, then they want to read their text messages. They want to read their journals. They want to read their diaries. They want to find out what they can. That's a very, you know, I say to parents, and then they say, well, I'm not going to tell my kid that I read their text messages because I want them to continue to text. And I say, well, if you're not going to do anything with the information, then don't have it. You know, the only reason to have it is if you're going to say, I see that you're suicidal, we're going to a hospital, you know. So I hesitate for parents reading journals and reading text messages. However, if their kids are very much unsafe, and the parents feel that that's something that they have to do, then that's something that they have to do. Privacy ends with a kid who's unsafe or using substances in the house in terms of searching their rooms, okay? I tell parents, you know, you're searching the room to find scissors, razors, drugs. You're not searching the room to read your kid's diary, okay? So there's, you know, sort of a dialectic, a middle path here, about I think that you need to maintain safety, and I think that you need to do what you can to maintain safety. And, you know, there are places where kids are going to have some of their own thoughts that you're not going to hear. So I encourage parents to open up dialogues with their kids. Again, I recommend for any kid that has self-harming or suicidal behaviors that they have a therapist, and that what goes on between the therapist and the kid is pretty confidential. And therapists will tell parents what they need to know when there's danger. But a lot of the time, parents are going to allow what's going on with the kid to go to the therapist. And that's, I think, really helpful, as long as there's a person who is keeping track of safety, which any DBT therapist is, who's keeping track of safety, who's keeping track of whether or not the kid needs more vigilance. So it's really a balancing act. And if it's the only way that you can know if your kid is safe, then it's something that you may have to do. I don't encourage parents to read journals. I don't encourage parents to read text messages. I do encourage them to search the room and to make sure that there's nothing in there that's potentially dangerous.
Okay. It can be such a fine line to follow.
Yeah.
When you're concerned about your child. What about Facebook? There are parents who insist that their child allow them on Facebook. You have any thoughts about that?
Again, I think it's a matter of if your kid is a pretty safe kid, all right, then I don't think you necessarily have to see what they're putting on Facebook. If your kid is communicating with strangers, is giving out their address, is putting out pictures of self-harm, then I think that they need to be monitored. And sometimes, you know, there are some apps that I encourage parents shut down, because there's a lot of danger out there in the internet. And kids that have intense emotions and kids that have emotion dysregulation tend to find all of them. And they find places that reinforce self-harm, where there's pictures of kids cutting, where there's meeting dangerous people. And so those are the situations in which I think parents have to be very vigilant, because safety is the prominent issue here. And if your kid is using Facebook or any other, and the kids aren't even using Facebook so much anymore, but any other app that is leading them to be getting reinforced for self-injury, to be reinforced for eating disorders, for getting sort of tons and tons of attention when they're depressed. We do have kids that when they are feeling really badly will send out text messages to their friends and say, I'm suicidal right now, and their parents don't know. So that's a different situation than should a parent in general monitor Facebook.
And I noticed that in your book, you actually have a list of apps that you would recommend to parents and children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of apps out there that provide guided imagery, that provide meditation, that provide mindfulness, breathing exercises, that provide soothing nature sounds and music. There are also apps that help kids monitor their own emotions. There are apps that kids actually use with DBT therapists to help them monitor what their emotions are, what their urges are, and then that gets shared with their therapist. So, yes, we do recommend that there are lots of apps that kids can actually use to be more mindful and to use skills and to be able to be to soothe themselves. Because ultimately, kids like this have to learn how they can soothe themselves, how they can take care of their, all that intensity that they're feeling, that they have in the past managed through unsafe and unhealthy means. They can learn to manage them through safe means. And just like I will coach parents through a difficult situation, a DBT therapist will coach a kid in between sessions so that they're using skills and not relying on unhealthy, unsafe ways of handling that.
Do you have one or two favorite apps that you tend to refer parents to?
Not really. I like this. There's a Serenity app that I actually like, but there's a lot of them. And so, I just ask parents to sort of look them up and check them out. But really, it's the kids that have to find things that work for them. And sometimes a parent recommendation, as you must know, parent recommendation to a kid means the kid's not going to do it.
Right.
Okay. So I sort of hesitate to tell parents to tell kids what to do. I encourage the parents to use it, to model that. Okay. I mean, one of the things that I encourage parents to do is to have, hand lotion everywhere in their house, okay, so that when they're really troubled or when they're fighting with their kids or whatever, they just put a little bit of lotion on their hands and rub it in very smoothly. That just sort of soothes them. And again, anytime, first of all, that lessens the reactivity between the parent and the kid, because the parent is able to stay calm. It's also modeling to the kids how to also stay calm. So it's not just apps, it's also having sort of things around that you can use to sort of help lessen emotional reactivity and emotional intensity for everybody in the family. Because if you have a kid who has that, you're going to tend to have the whole family is going to be tense a lot on.
I'm noticing with some of the tools that you're discussing that they're readily available. Mm-hmm. They're kind of easy to do, and perhaps take some of the worry for parents out of really negotiating or navigating changes with themselves, with their children, and in their households.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really there's a lot of things that parents can do and a lot of ways that they can make their house safe and a lot of ways that they can make their house calmer, okay? And, you know, the calm, you know, if you have a kid who feels intensity and there's, say, fighting between parents or tension between parents, that exacerbates the kid's intensity. Okay, so, you know, one of the things I talk to parents about is, first of all, parents taking timeouts, but also parents negotiating what goes on clearly behind closed doors, and taking their tension elsewhere, taking walks. You know, sometimes parents will say, you know, I'm going to take a walk because I need to sort of soothe myself. Do you want to come with me? Walking pets is one of the best self-soothes that kids can do. But really, you can't tell a kid what to do. You sort of have to model it or do it with them. But yeah, I mean, lots of things that we just do on a regular basis, you know, petting a pet, you know, having your pet with you is incredibly comforting to kids and to parents. And so any of those things are the things that you can use to soothe yourself. I mean, there's thousands of ways that people can soothe themselves, and they just have to find what works for them, and then their kids have to find what works for them. And sometimes parents tell me that what will work one time won't work another time for their kid, even when they're sort of, you know, suggesting things. And so you have to have sort of a handful of things that work and that you know work.
You know, it's interesting that you've said, you know, don't tell the child what to do, because that means they're absolutely not going to do it, which is...
Well, not absolutely, but a lot of the time.
You're right. Thank you for the correction. But it's true. A lot of the times they're just not going to do it. But for those parents who said, you know what, my job as a parent and my parents' job as parents and their parents' jobs as parents was to tell the child what to do and to expect that the child would do it and punish if the child did not as a way of learning. What do you say to that philosophy?
That punishment doesn't work.
Okay.
That research actually shows that punishment doesn't work, that we have to really be able to focus on what's positive and reinforce what's positive and the behaviors that we want to have. Punishment only says don't do this. Reinforcement says this is what I want you to do. The other thing is that basic parenting doesn't always work with a kid who has emotional difficulties. Even if it works with your other kids, it doesn't always work with the kid that is having emotional challenges and mental health challenges. And so what I say to parents is what you're doing working? Is it making your family calmer? Is it making your kid healthier and better and safer? And parents will say, no, it's not effective. And I said, well, then we got to try something different. And even though, yes, we were all raised in a certain way, I was too, it doesn't mean that we all can't learn new behaviors so that we can become more effective. Some of the things I teach parents are not intuitive, you know, that if your kid's really, really angry, don't keep talking to them. They're not able to hear you. But some parents think, well, you got to stay here and we got to work it out right now. It doesn't work. You got to let your kid go away, and you got to go away and calm down and then come back, and then it might work better. So what I basically say to parents, if it's not working, then we got to do something different. And so what are we going to do that's different that also feels okay? And so we try to find this balance. Not every parent can do what I'm recommending also, and I have to work with that. You know, like I have to find a middle path that a parent can actually do that might make, you know, minor changes along the way until we can make bigger changes. But if it's not working, then it doesn't make sense for us to continue to do it.
Fair enough. Pat Harvey, co-author with Britt Rathbone of Parenting a Teen Who Has Intense Emotions, DBT Skills to Help Your Teen Navigate Emotional and Behavioral Changes. And what's really wonderful about this book, Pat, I think you probably already know this since you co-wrote it, is that it includes step-by-step guidance for responding to specific problematic behaviors. I would be surprised if this book stays on the shelf for very long. But Pat Harvey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Can I put out my website if anybody wants more information?
Absolutely.
It is patharveymsw.com.
Okay, and would you spell...
And there's information about all the things I've talked about on there.
And would you spell your name?
P-A-T-H-A-R-V-E-Y and then MSW.
Okay, .com. Pat, in closing, are there any words that you would like to share with the parent who has learned that his or her teen does have intense emotions and they're just kind of feeling at wit's end? What would you want them to think about or do?
one, not to blame or feel guilt or operate out of fear, that their kids' problems are not their fault, that there is help out there, absolutely there's help out there for their kids, there's help out there for the parents, that new behaviors can be learned, that change can occur. I made significant changes after learning DBT. I was already, I don't even want to say this, in my 40s. That change really can occur for their kids and for them, that there's help out there, and that these are behaviors. These are not necessarily character flaws and that they're nobody's fault. That we have to understand that kids are under a lot of pressure and so are parents, and we need to take the blame and the judgments. We need to take judgments out of things and sort of just describe what we see, because what we see and we describe, we can change. And that's what I would really like to send out to parents.
Well,
and just slow down and breathe.
Thank you very much for that. I think you've provided a lot of hope and certainly a different perspective for many of our listeners. Again, PatHarveyMSW.com, co-author with Britt Rathbone of Parenting a Teen Who Has Intense Emotions. Thank you, Pat.
Sure, thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to take the place of any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can do so by sending me an email at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at MindTalk, MYNDTALK.org. And folks, I want you to remember always that if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.